Welcome to you all. My name is Tracy Perkins. I'm the Administrative Director for the Eye Research Institute, and we want to thank you for joining us for the first lecture of the Eye Research Institute seminar series. You can find a list of the seminars for the rest of the year out on the table that you passed on your way in, and we hope you will join us for some of those in the upcoming months. We would like to acknowledge the gracious support of the University Lectures Committee and our co-sponsors for this event, the UW Preoptometry Club, the Evolution Initiative, and the Departments of Genetics and Medical Genetics and Pathobiological Sciences. I now invite Dick Dubelzig of the Department of Pathobiological Sciences to introduce our guest speaker.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, welcome. Yesterday when I agreed to introduce Ivan, I was handed a rather large stack of papers documenting or laying out a very distinguished career. And I spent some time last night going through that, and really the only thing I think I'm going to say about from the stack of distinguished accomplishments is that Dr. Schwab is a physician. He's an ophthalmologist, an academic ophthalmologist at the University of California in Davis, and he's the director of the corneal service. In his clinical practice, he specializes in the surgical and medical treatment of diseases of the anterior surface of the eye. And believe me, I've waded through his credentials, and in his field, he's a very, very credentialed individual. And you're going to have to either look him up, Google him, or take my word for that. Because what I want to talk about now is Ivan Schwab, the enthusiast, and that's the Ivan that I've come to know. I think it'll be abundantly clear that Ivan and I share a common interest in comparative ocular anatomy and function, and an interest in how that anatomy and function can be viewed in trying to come to grips and understand the evolution of the eye. Ivan has demonstrated to me that he's a tireless enthusiast. He goes around, he's like an Indiana Jones. He goes around the country and collects specimens and graphics and anything that might be useful to put together the story of ocular evolution or comparative ocular anatomy and function. I'm lucky in that when he comes across something really interesting, he often sends it to my lab, so we get to share in the excitement, and then we occasionally get to see Ivan here so we can exchange ideas. I'll warn you, though, a disclaimer that you're here at your own risk, because I think you'll find that Ivan's enthusiasm is infectious, and I'll ask you to put your hands together and give Ivan a good badge of welcome.
Thanks for that, Dick. Did you ever wonder how it all began? Did you ever wonder how we started, how we got an eye? Well, I'm going to go through in the next 6 hours the mechanism for the formation of an eye with some gaps, perhaps. What was the stimulus for the start of vision? I'm not sure this is going to work for me, so I may have to change this by hand. What was the start? What confined an eye? And that's basically the electromagnetic spectrum. The visible and nearly visible light is really the principal source of what drove the eye. And so with 10 to the 14th sunrises and sunsets for the extraction of energy, the light spectrum across the Earth has really driven the formation of the sensory mechanisms. Earth started perhaps 4.5 billion years ago, and by 3.9 billion years ago, there were nucleic acids, RNA, membrane, and the dawn of life probably came about 3.75 billion years ago. And that dawn ushered in a time of evolution. It began the process. It began with prokaryotes, single cells without a nucleus. These probably began as blue-green algae or organisms like them, the so-called stromatolites, still in existence, still extant on Western Australia, a small area in the Bahamas. Those organisms anaerobes would produce oxygen, and that would become very important to the rest of our story. And incidentally, you'll see at the bottom of my slides a timeline and an arrow at about the time period I'm discussing. We are passing out a handout which will give you a timeline if you're confused by some of the terms, because the timeline of evolution can be divided up into periods, eras, periods, and you'll see that it can be confusing with all the names, and this will help. Oh, and incidentally, one point I forgot to start with. I have no proprietary interest in anything I'm going to discuss today. I'm supposed to say that at any university function. Now, I mentioned that oxygen accumulated, and this is a picture of blue-green algae and the oxygen bubbling off of it. So you can imagine over billions of years, oxygen is going to produce and be produced and be part of the atmosphere. Well, how did evolution select the components for the eye? Well, first it selected a proton pump, an energy source, retinol, and combined it with an opsin that eventually would become rhodopsin. After all, cells need an energy source, and that was the proton pump retinol to start. By the time the opsins were selected, and eventually by the metazoa, all those opsins were virtually the same. All metazoa and multiple cellular animals have virtually the same opsins. There's some differences, but these are ancient molecules, ancient proteins. And a PAX6-like protein appeared very early. In coral, not quite PAX6, but a PAX-like protein appeared in coral, even Volvox. And yet that's not enough for an eye. Coral doesn't have an eye after all. The switches, the genetic machinery downstream from the PAX genes control the direction and the morphology of what would later be eye formation. But it's still phototropism. It is still a single cell seeking sunlight. But in that, seawater will determine transmission. So we still, even today, seek the sun. But at the time this was formed, it was seawater that determined the transmission. And that's important to our story and the way the eye developed. So now, at 2.2 billion years ago, we're already halfway through the story, aren't we? Because the Earth started 4.5 billion years ago. By this time, single-cell animals with a nucleus, eukaryotes, appeared. The anaerobes, those prokaryotes that didn't like oxygen, were often intolerant of oxygen. So they began to be driven out, and the eukaryotes evolved. The eukaryotes, those cells with a nucleus, would often develop eye spots. Now, I remember I said the proton pump was present. Those molecules of opsin and retinol, and they combined into an eye spot in at least some creatures. This is Euglena, you see on the right. It has a little flagellum out here, and it doesn't go the way you might think. In fact, this would be the head, if you will, of the organism. It travels in this direction with a propeller-like activity of its flagellum. But there are other interesting eukaryotes that developed, protists. And the protists have gone on their merry way to be a very important part of our biomass. And they, too, have continued to evolve, continued to diversify and mature, essentially. And I'm going to tell you about this protist, which will give you some insight into what animals are capable of with a long enough throat. This is Erythrodyniopsis. It is approximately 50 microns. In that 50 microns, it contains, it's a single cell, it contains subcellular elements that make an eye. Here's a lens, here's a pigment cup. This membrane folds within the pigment cup, and it's filled with photopigment, although we don't know which one. It's a predator. It chases things. It has a flagellum, this end, and yet it has no neurons, so it's an eye without a brain. As we ophthalmologists like to say, the eye is not an outpouching of the brain, but rather the brain is an outpouching of the eye. It has perhaps 2 to 3 times the genome that you have. What's it doing with all that? We don't know. So once the cells begin to collect in a condominium-like collection, sponges develop, multicellular animals. These are the first metazoa. They were often light sensitive in some way, although not necessarily with an eye. So sponges or animals like them were probably the first multicellular animals. These are like condominiums filled with people, and they all work on their own. They're not cooperative. But with time, those inhabitants begin to work together so that pretty soon organs appeared. Jellyfish appeared, probably related to the first common or the last common ancestor of sponges, probably came off from the same stem organism. And those jellyfish have gone on their merry way, not really leading to any extant phyla now. But the jellyfish have matured of their own, and they've done it in such a way that they have created their own eyes. And this is Tripodelia cystophora, the box jellyfish. It's been in the news lately because these little tiny brown spots, four of them on each side of the box, ropilia they're called, they have eyes. And if you look at the eyes, you will see that there's at least one camera-style eye, it turns out there are two, and there are four little eyes around the sides, which are more simple eyes. This pupil even works. And here's a picture of the histology, if you would do a histologic cut of this. And here is such an eye. Sure looks like an eye to me, and yet this animal is of an ancient lineage, although a relative newcomer. I mentioned that the eye probably preceded the brain, at least in some measure. Sensory mechanisms drove the formation of the brain, not necessarily the eye. Olfaction played an important role, and hearing probably played an important role too. But the brain was in many ways driven by the brain. Brain was driven by the eye. Now, along about this time, about 600 million years ago, we're beginning to be on the precipice of a Cambrian explosion. So the materials had to be present for all these phyla to appear in the Cambrian. And one of the important creatures that appeared at this time was a worm of some sort. This is an annelid known as Platyneris. And you'll note that there are two eye spots, and those eye spots are the classic invertebrate eyes, and it has the classic invertebrate photopigments and mechanisms of photoreception that other invertebrates know. But deep in its brain, it also has the ciliary photopigments that you have in your eye. That means that this creature, this worm, has the mechanisms for invertebrate and vertebrate photoreception. So a worm appearing in the Ediacaran probably gave rise to both vertebrates and invertebrates. Now, I'd also point out that this was an important time because we know the worms appeared at this time because there are streaks in the rocks. There's no sample. These are not animals that fossilized. But we know there was movement. Why is that important? It's important because it's a third layer. Up until this time, jellyfish included, there are only two layers called diploblasts. These are triploblasts, meaning that all of a sudden evolution took a leap, and they made an animal that had muscle. So it moved. It moved towards what? Does it move towards a mate? Does it move towards food? The important step was movement. Second important step that occurred was cephalization. A head. All of a sudden animals developed a head. This isn't a given in evolution. The head develops. This was an important evolutionarily. And note that it's bilateral. So this is past the bilateralian stage, meaning that the animals have become bilaterally symmetrical. Important steps in the development of life, but also important to the eye. So when did the first eyes appear? And you'll note that I had this before my slide on the Cambrian explosion because I think that the precursor of the trilobites I'm going to show you here probably appeared in the Ediacaran, that is, even before fossilizable elements were available, even before we can be sure that it appeared. My bet is that it did appear. This is the dorsal surface of an older or more mature trilobite. And the trilobites appeared at least about 540 million years ago. And they had compound eyes with complex elements. I'm going to show you the side view of this eye, and this is the eye, this is the head. I'm going to show you the side view in just a moment. The interesting thing about these eyes is that the eyes are really quite mature. They have a complex structure. They have two focusing lenses called a Huygens-Descartes correction lens. You'll hear more about this in a few minutes. And these elements look like omatidia. And omatidia is not a breast disease. It's the individual units of a fly's eye or any compound eye. Each individual unit is an omatidium, and the group together is an omatidia. These are really aspherical corneal lenses I'm going to show you from a side view. And this means that this was an effort to eliminate spherical aberration, meaning it probably didn't have color vision, probably had one visual pigment. Remember, it's controlled by seawater, so this is probably a visual pigment sensitive in the blue range. And it doesn't want to have spherical aberration, a blurred image. So these lenses are probably present to eliminate spherical aberration. And certainly by this time, the first brain had probably appeared. And again, I believe this has been driven by the sensory input, and the eye is part of that. Now, here's a side view of the same animal. And incidentally, these two slides are not mine. They're from Ricardo Libre-Sehi, who is a physicist out of Chicago. And his story will begin something that will be a thread through this talk, and that is he is a physicist first, but his interest and really his hobby was figuring out the optics, collecting trilobites. What fun it must have been growing up in this man's household, because his weekends, his summers, were spent in places where there were trilobites, Morocco, so forth. He's collected trilobites and is a world authority on it now. You'll note that there are lots of omatidia. Each one of these is a Huygens-Descartes correction lens. So this is the lead up to the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion occurred about 543 million years ago to about 505. Now, eyes begin to appear. And as eyes appear, the visual pressure becomes enormous. The predation begins to press on all animals. The selection pressure begins to press on all animals to develop eyes of some sort. And it does happen. A fantastic array of animal phyla appears. We only have about 7, maybe 8 phyla of eyes, or animals with eyes that survive. But this was a very important time on Earth with the production of these multiple phyla. This is Animalocorus. This is a predator of the Cambrian seas, about the size of a small ray. And note that the eyes on the front here have to be eyes, probably compound eyes, although we're not sure of that. This is Wapitia. Note also here, 2 eyes. These are relatively small creatures, but they fill the waters of the Cambrian seas. Perspicaris, these have to be eyes and probably compound eyes. Arthropoda really had its beginning in the Cambrian, at least in the Cambrian. So of the 7 phyla that survived, 3 are very important, and we'll spend most of our time on those. Arthropoda, Mollusca, and of course us, chordates. Now the ocular morphology also exploded during the Cambrian explosion. The carnivory and predation pushed the animals that could survive, that couldn't survive, pushed them out, and the animals that could survive, it pushed them to develop better visual mechanisms, pushed them to obtain better mechanisms of defense and attack. With that, sensory mechanisms had to be improved. The mollusks appeared, probably starting in the Ediacaran. They have an everted retina. That means that their photoreceptor points out towards our lens. Remember that your retina is inverted. The photoreceptor points back towards the back of your eye, not towards the lens. We'll talk about that in a bit. But the point is, in the mollusks, the photoreceptor points out towards the lens. They've developed a pinhole camera. Photographers in the audience will know that one. They've developed a regular camera-style eye, very much like our own. And they've developed mirror optics. And the mirror optics developed within this group, within this phyla, very interesting and are illustrated by this scallop. These little blueberries you see are each one of them, are an eye. Each one has a lens, no cornea, has a lens, and it has two layers of retina. Not one like you do, two layers of retina. It's a cyst. It's circular, and the back of the cyst is lined with one layer of photoreceptors. And immediately behind the lens is another layer of photoreceptors. So there's really two layers of retina with a gap in between. How does this eye work? Well, it's mirror optics. And for those of you that own telescopes, it's very much like a Schmidt-Cassegrain. Light comes in, reflected off this back curve. It strikes the first retina, then strikes and focuses on the second retina. So these are mirror optics. The principle started in the Cambrian and would not be repeated until approximately the 1960s in telescopy. The arthropods appeared, as I mentioned, and they also created a lot of unusual eyes. They had to. They had this carnivory predation pressure. They produced pit eyes, telephoto multiple lens eyes, scanning multiple lenses, and of course the chordates then appear. And we actually have rather pedestrian eyes compared to what else appeared. The versatility and the diversity is not so much in the chordates, but really is in the molluscs and the arthropods. Well, let's talk a little bit just about some of these things that appeared about these times. The nautiloids and the ammonoids appeared, and although the nautilus you see here appeared later, this represents the ammonoids. And this was the earliest camera-style eye, and it's a camera-style because it's a pinhole eye, and here it is. This is a close-up, and this is the pinhole eye. This isn't very effective. It isn't a particularly good eye, but you can imagine that you put a lens in here and pretty soon you have a regular camera-style eye. And sure enough, the ammonoids, nautiloids, eventually radiate into the cephalopods. And here is Billy. And I want to thank the Seattle Aquarium for allowing me to get close to this specific giant octopus. They warned me not to give her my hand. She weighed 150 pounds, very friendly, but wanted my hand. This is a good example of the theme I want to run through here. I showed interest in this creature and spoke to Robert Anderson, who's a curator at the museum, the Aquatic Museum in the Seattle Aquarium, and told him what I was interested in, and he allowed me not only to get close to the animal, but he sat down with me for a couple hours, told me what the creature can do. Point being, and the point is really to students of all ages, that the investigators, the people doing this work, are eager to share this with you, eager to help you with your projects. You only have to ask. You only have to show interest. And you have the cachet of a university behind you to help that interest. Just a little bit of encouragement that you'll hear that, throughout the talk. So this is a lens of an octopus, not Billy. This lens, you'll note, has a line through it. This is not an artifact. These two halves are two different waves of ectoderm. In other words, embryologically, this is very different from our own eye. And even though it resembles our eye in some respects, it's quite different. It's in the invertebrate class, quite different eye. And about this time, the basic compound eye was developing too. This basic compound eye is seen in mollusks, annelids, arthropods. And it's probably the ancestral form, that is, the apposition eye. This is probably the first compound eye. A compound eye is the one that has all the multiple facets that you see in insects or other animals with many faceted eyes. These are good eyes, but not great eyes. They're limited by diffraction, and that is, as they get smaller, they don't particularly pick up the light well, tends to break apart, a process called diffraction. Nevertheless, they're useful. They do pick up movement well. And this is a worm. This is a cybellid worm. It's related. It is an annelid. It's one of those groups that develops an eye. And here's a close-up of the head of that stalk, and that's its eye. And here's a histology image of it, and I want to thank Greg Rouse for this image. You'll note that this looks sort of like an ice cream cone. This is a compound eye. But the trick here is it's a little different from the eye that you'll see in flies. Here is a fly's eye, and this is a fly's eye from the eosin. This is in amber, which has been scanned for me by a man with a Jess Roost from Germany, and I thank him for that image as well. And here is an example of a compound eye, an apposition compound eye, very much like this eye, and I thank Dick de Bilzing for this particular image. These look relatively similar, and you can see how the morphology is similar, and it probably developed under the same stimulus, but the biochemistry is entirely different. The cebellid worm has signal proteins very much like yours, and the fly has signal proteins very much like an invertebrate. So that means that these processes were set up probably after they diverged, which says a lot about the timing of photoreception, meaning it was probably very early in the Cambrian or even in the late Ediacaran, maybe as long as 550, even 600 million years ago. Compound eyes appeared. I mentioned the apposition. The apposition eye would radiate into two more eyes, afocal apposition and neural superposition, but both of these appear only in terrestrial or aerial animals. We'll get to those in a minute, and I won't spend more than 6 or 8 hours on each of them, as I'm sure you'll appreciate. The marine animals, however, developed different kind of eyes, reflecting superposition, refracting superposition, and parabolic superposition. Now, you don't want me to spend a lot of time on that, but if you really want to invite me back, I'll talk about the invertebrate eyes, but I really don't think you want to hear a lot about the invertebrate eyes because it's distinguish them is significant optically, even biochemically, but there's a lot of information. But I do want to give you some information. And here's perhaps the best compound eye on Earth. This is the mantis shrimp. Now, the mantis shrimp is about the size of a large bratwurst, maybe a little less than a foot, 8 inches in length. And you'll note that these two eyes look funny. They've got strips across the center. Those are concentrated on the tibia. And this animal can move its eyes independently, up or down. But that's not the really interesting part about this animal. Just to remind you, you have 3 visual pigments. This animal has 16 visual pigments. It can see linearly polarized light. It can see circular polarized light. And even that isn't the most astonishing thing when you know its lifestyle. This creature lives by breaking open clams or stunning fish. And it does so with these hammers it has here. And those hammers can retract back and be the first or second fastest movement in nature in acceleration. And it can crack a clamshell open or stun and kill a fish. It has the power at the tip of that hammer of a 22 shell, and it can crack its way out of your aquarium if it chooses to. Scuba divers know this creature as the thumb splitter because you stick your hand into his lair and he will break your thumb or at least crack the thumbnail. So the arthropods develop many of these unusual eyes. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. We'll talk a bit about them in the aerial and terrestrial eyes, but again, I won't spend a lot of time on them. Afocal apposition appeared later in the butterflies. It's a bit of a telescope, about a 4-power telescope because of the way the lenses are offset. As I said, it's interesting optics, but that might be a story for another time. Now, I mentioned that the elements of the eye were selected to create an eye early. The elements were selected early, but not all of the elements of the eye were selected so early. The lenses do not have a common origin. In other words, the lenses of the eyes are of different origin. Many of the aquatic eyes that we'll talk about have different heat shock proteins, different enzymes, even eyes made of stone, calcite, for example. The trilobites I mentioned have calcite lenses. There are other animals. Brittle stars have calcite lenses. And this creature is a good example of lens formation and how creative evolution can get. This is Pontella. This is the eye of Pontella. It has 3 lenses. 1, 2, 3. These 2 lenses together
are Huygens-Descartes correctional lens. That's the same lens that the trilobites developed, and they're probably not even closely related. So this was probably developed independently. This last lens, then, receives rays that are not spherically aberrated. In other words, they have no spherical aberration, and again, it probably has just one visual pigment. And that visual pigment is housed in the eye, you see here, in six photoreceptors that are asymmetrically aligned in a what is called center surround system. What does that mean? Well, it means that it's the system neurologically can see something in the center of a bigger target. Why would it be like this? These nocular eyes, so-called, are only found in males. In essence, this is an eye for the ladies. This eye for the ladies has evolved because the males are approximately 96% of the mating mass that accumulates when they come to mate. So the males that can see the females correctly and mate with them, their genes will be carried on. And it turns out the females are blue with a yellow spot. So although it's not known for sure, presumably this centered surround system is meant for the females and meant to allow the males to find the females more quickly. Batholichthyops excellus, for you ichthyologists, it's a benthic, almost abyssal fish that has four lenses. Lenses are easy to develop. It's not something that's hard to develop for evolution. Coppelia is another interesting animal with a lens system, even a scanning lens system, and here it is. This lens system is interesting because of the design of the optics. This is in mid to epiphyletic waters, and you can note the two lenses on the front and they don't move, and you can note immediately behind this, these two are not exactly the same species. You can note immediately behind the second lens, so light comes in here, focuses here, comes in here, and focuses here. Now, what use would this odd eye be? Well, again, it has just a few photoreceptors, and it's a scanning eye. These outer lenses don't move. Only this inner lens moves back and forth. And it scans, but it doesn't scan like your eye scans. It scans exactly the opposite. It scans in and then out. Not like your eye. Completely different neurologically. Why? Well, this animal has a point retina. So it has to scan the field. It'll scan, 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 very much like your TV screen. It'll go down, then start over and go down again to image, and it probably is somehow remembering part of that image. That's two dimensions. Why does it get the third dimension? And the third dimension probably is present because of rising and falling plankton that it feeds on. They rise and fall in crepuscular, that's twilight, and that is dawn and dusk. Well, about this time, the vertebrates dawned as well. Picaea gracilens in the Cambrian still appeared very early in the Cambrian. This is a protochordate, a cephalochordate, not quite a chordate, not quite a vertebrate. Probably related to Amphioxus, which this is, and the animal probably appeared very much like Amphioxus. This animal had eye spots, very rudimentary eyes, and probably led to the first agnathans, or jawless fish, quite early, about 540 million years ago. And those were probably hagfish-like animals, but hagfish are sister groups. They're off on the side. But lampreys are probably very close to the lineage of vertebrates that eventually would give rise to us. And here is Geatria australis. Geatria australis is one of two lampreys in southern waters. This creature has five visual pigments. Remember I told you, you have three. And this creature has five already, even by this time. So that means somewhere along the line, fish even lost one of those visual pigments, because most fish have only four visual pigments. And certainly by the time mammals appeared, we'd lost two more. And we'll get to that story. Here's a picture of that eye. Again, I want to thank Dr. DeBielzig for this image. And you'll note that this eye is encased in a very small, thin coating. This is called a primitive cornea. This is not part of the skin, the cornea, but rather is overlying skin. This is part of early evolution of the cornea, and we'll come back to that story a bit. So The hagfish and lampreys appear about 540 million years ago. The lampreys have a fish-like eye. Really, they're fish. The fish begin to evolve. The elasmobranchs, such as the rays and sharks, evolve, and they probably develop the first rods, those cells that can see in darker, dimmer light. And those probably appeared about 450 million years ago in rays. And about this time, geologically speaking, about 400 million years ago, lungfish, those fish that would eventually become related to, at least, the animals that would come on shore, the tetrapods, appeared. And the fish dominated, 28,000 species, still do. But the Devonian ended about 362 million years ago, rather suddenly and rather violently. But not before rods had appeared. This is a ray. Note the odd pupil. The odd pupil probably creates a mechanism for closing off light stimulus in an eye that's predominantly a rod retina. And the lungfish appeared, and they'll become important to our story in just a moment. But during the Devonian and forward, fish have played with ocular design and evolved all sorts of unusual mechanisms. This is periophthalmos. This is a fish that can raise and lower its eyes like periscopes. Note this fish also has a very unusual set of sunglasses. These are pigment flecks between that primitive cornea I showed you and the next layer that was developing. There's a space there, and sunglasses appeared. Well, what was this fish-like eye that developed? Well, it was a large globe, or is a large globe. It has minimal pupillary movement, at least in the teleosts, not in the elasmobranchs. They actually have pupils that move. The cornea was flat, is flat. The lens is large, round, and the fish accommodate, that is, change focus, not by changing the shape of the lens like you do, but rather by moving the lens back and forth. The lens can move front to back and even move from the nose towards the temporal side by muscular action. And here's an example of a fish with a fish lens. Note that it protrudes beyond the pupil, creating a larger field. This is a predator fish, a Korean angelfish. And you may notice when you go to the aquarium that there's a small notch in the pupil, creating what is called the aphakic space. And here is exactly the reason for it. When light goes into this eye, if there was a pupil edge here, it would be blocked. But light goes into this eye and strikes the peripheral retina, where the fovea is. And the fovea is that critical part of vision you use to read the newspaper, the best concentration of cells. Fish enlarge their eyes as they grow. The eye gets bigger. So what would happen to the eye as it gets bigger? And those photoreceptors move around the retina. Well, what happens is the fovea will move out of the line of sight unless there are photoreceptive stem cells. In other words, photoreceptor stem cells that make more of themselves. And that's exactly what happens. The photoreceptors make more retinal cells throughout the life of the fish. Here is a wonderful area of investigation to look for making new developmental, new retinal cells for humans, because somehow fish get around the idea that you only have one set of photoreceptors. I mentioned the sunglasses appeared because of that extra space between the cornea. We'll get into that just a little more, but I want to show you an image of what a fish eye looks like. The lens is very large, fills much of the globe. The globe is quite flat. Cornea is quite flat. Remember, the index of refraction of water is very similar to the cornea, so the cornea doesn't do much in the way of refraction. Hence, there's no reason for it to be steep. No reason for it to be a refractive element. Now, by this time, there's really no vascularization of the retina. There's no feeding of the retina with blood vessels. So fish got around this by squeezing vessels from the middle layer, the choroid, into the vitreous cavity. And this inner layer of cells, called a falciform process, will distribute nutrients to the inner retina. Now, I mentioned the Devonian as an important time, and not only as a key time for fish, but as a key time for terrestrial species as well. Insects first appeared on land in the late Devonian. Probably the first predators were dragonflies and spiders, probably mayflies among the very first insects, or at least their predecessors. tetrapods appeared. And the tetrapods appeared probably several times. And as they appeared, some fantastic creatures with 7 or 8 digits, some were winnowed out, and one with 5 digits, eventually led to the rest of the vertebrate line. But this was a time of key neurologic changes, especially among the amphibians. The tapetum appeared probably more than once, but especially this was a time of insects, especially the late Devonian. The insects appeared, and just like with the Cambrian explosion, the insects that appeared were fighting for their life, evolving. The selection pressure was probably great, and with that, the spiders probably self-selected, and as they diverged and came forward, they developed some very interesting visual elements. This is a jumping spider, and for those of you that garden, you'll know this animal. You'll see this animal in your garden as a very friendly, almost charismatic spider, if I could use that word. If you haven't thought about or watched a jumping spider, pick one up. They don't bite. And if you watch them move back, if you move back and forth, you watch them jump to move back and forth because they can't move their eyes. So they'll have to jump back and forth to follow you. However, they too have a scanning eye, and their photoreceptors within their carapace move back and forth in a scanning mechanism much like copepilia, although their retina is richer in terms of the number of cells. But of course, we're more interested in the tetrapod. And the tetrapods appeared in the late Devonian, came on shore, represented here by the tiger salamander. And the amphibians then would develop in the Devonian and subsequently. We'll talk about the amphibians and the later development of vertebrates. Now, I mentioned some of the other eyes that had appeared, the compound eyes that had appeared in the Cambrian. And just to say a few words about the refracting superposition, another invertebrate eye, it's as good as the apposition eye, that first eye, except it's a more effective eye at collecting photons. It's more effective in darkness, probably 1,000 times more sensitive, and seen in moths and nocturnal insects. The moths use it to become predators of other insects, and the nocturnal insects probably use it to escape predators, except for one, and that is the hummingbird hawk moth. The hummingbird hawk moth is a diurnal, daily moth, and this one comes out and uses this extra sensitivity to create improved vision, rivaling the mantis shrimp I talked to you about, and he uses it to insert this long proboscis down the flower to seek nectar. He has a proboscis about 3.5 inches long, which he can unroll and roll up and stick down the flower. And he has pretty good vision, as I said, in the quality of the mantis shrimp, although not as many visual pigments. Well, I mentioned that the amphibians appeared, and the amphibians include the tetrapods, but our amphibians that are extant today probably appeared about 354 million years ago, without a tapetum, although the tapetum probably appeared in the spiders. The cornea became steeper, became clearer. Optics had to be. This animal was a terrestrial or land-based animal. However, it still moved its lens very much like fish. The accommodation was still piscine. It changed focus by moving the lens. But here, now that the animal was terrestrial, the eyelids began to appear, the nasal lacrimal duct appeared. And this became an important step towards binocularity, and it has a good story. All of these animals have a good story. I'm just telling you some of them. This animal, the frogs, have an interesting step towards our neurologic development, and here goes. Fish have a completely crossed chiasm, meaning all the fibers from the left eye go to the right side of the brain, all the fibers from the right side of the brain, the right eye go to the left side of the brain, completely crossed. But somewhere along the line, animals that came on shore split. That is, half of the fibers from the right side, right eye, go to the right side of the brain, but half go to the left side, partially crossing. Same thing with the other eye. When did this occur? It occurred here. Both metaphorically and literally, it occurs between the tadpoles, who have an entirely fish-like eye, to
to the frogs who have a terrestrial eye. It is at this metamorphosis where the chiasm expresses genes that begin to direct the new growth cones from the retina to come back and direct them down one course or another down the optic tract. I can just see them there. They have names like netons and semaphorins. I can see them holding up their semaphores and saying, that fiber goes this way, that fiber goes this way, in metamorphosis. And to boot, the next way station, called the lateral tuniculate, or in frog, it has another name, is expressing another gene, expressing another protein, calling them in so that topographically they resemble the retina. So this is a neat time of metamorphosis, teaching us that this is the step where the key neurologic step of binocularity, stereopsis, probably occurred. The reptiles appeared about 340 million years ago as a common amniote. There are three basic lineages, mostly terrestrial. The synapsids, now the synapsids turn out to be mammals later, but they probably start out like a creature known as Dimetrodon, something you probably played with as a dinosaur. It was entirely different in terms of its lineage. Parareptiles appeared in the form of turtles. Reptiles in terms of crocs and snakes and lizards. The snakes became fossorial, went underground. And then as the snakes reemerged, some of them even developed infrared vision. And this may have been because of this fossorial trip going underground. They may have developed infrared for other reasons. But the family of Boidae you see here, as well as the pit vipers, developed a sense of infrared. And that infrared projects onto the visual cortex equivalent in snakes so that they actually do see in infrared. And when you see those pictures on TV specials about seeing the mouse moving in infrared, that is exactly what they see. They integrate it with their vision. Now here's an example of a snake eye. They still have a large lens, but the reptiles are about the point where accommodation, the ability to change focus, changed from movement of the lens to lens deformation. The reptiles also have interesting features. This is a sea snake. They have extra ocular photoreceptors in their tail so that they can drag their tail under the rocks as they're being attacked by sharks or sea eagles. The snakes have become very versatile once they reemerge from their fossorial life. The reptiles appeared in a variety of forms. Crocodiles appeared about 250 million years ago, and here definitely the lens accommodates by deformation. This is done rapidly with striated as opposed to smooth muscle, which we have. The crocs and other reptiles appeared and then diverged. The crocs more closely related to the dinosaurs and eventually more closely related to birds. And another separate animal appeared, the Tuatara, Sphenodon, with an interesting feature to tell you about. This is a reptile group of a sort, but it's not a true reptile. It's its own phylum. This animal has a well-studied parietal eye, a third eye, if you will, and here it is. Note that the lens is poorly formed. You could probably call this a cornea, but it's overlying skin, and there's a small pore overlying it with the retina. This is a third eye, and it's there not for visual perception, but rather for circadian rhythm. So I mentioned that crocs radiated off closely related to dinosaurs. Dinosaurs through the theropods radiate into the birds. And the birds probably appeared about 150 million years ago in the form of Archaeopteryx, although evidence from China makes it appear they probably appeared earlier. They are closer to the crocs and dinosaurs, especially the theropods. Other reptiles radiated in different directions. Some are still with us. But the birds are really the triumph of evolution, at least visual evolution. The adaptations of birds have become important, such things as a double chiasm, two crossings to get around that problem of a single crossing. They have a double fovea, two individual sights that you have one of, allows you to read the newspaper, that area of critical vision. They have fantastic abilities. They're wing feeders. They can catch animals on the wing. They can
be waders and get around the glare off of the water where they feed. They can be woodpeckers and create holes in trees without damaging their eyes. So this is really the triumph of evolution. This is the best that evolution has to offer visually, at least so far. Birds are very eye-minded, large eyes. They have rapid accommodation produced by striated musculature. They don't have retinal vessels. They have a pectin to nourish the inner retina, and they do so with oscillatory movements. The eye twists a bit, and the pectin will move and shimmy to distribute the nutrients. They, too, have four visual pigments, much like many fish. These are often densely packed with excellent vision, and I'm going to show you what they can do with the vision. I want you to be sure and watch the picture of this eagle when he takes the fish out of the water. It moves rather quickly, so watch carefully. I'll try to point this out for you. Notice he's coming in, raises his alula, sort of slows down, flaps down. Now watch, looks down. He uses that second fovea for stereopsis once he's just at the right point to pull the fish out in case a fish has been diving a bit. But of course, we're more interested in the evolution of our own eye. That comes from a line of synapsids from a common amniote. And those are the mammals and our kin, such as the monotremes, and these are mammals as well. Marsupials. Mammals appeared about 125 million years ago. And these radiations would explode at Chicxulub when the meteor struck just off the Yucatan. This is the echidna, an interesting mammal. Gives pink milk from its sebaceous glands on its tummy. Doesn't really have a pouch, not much of a pouch, but it is closely related to the marsupials. This is the fat-tailed dunnart. This dunnart has four visual pigments. Curious enough, they've probably come along with that ancestor. They're not really lost until the mammals take to the night, become nocturnal. And when the mammals become nocturnal, they lose two of those four, so they're down to two visual pigments. Well, then what happens if we're down to two visual pigments? How do we get back to the three visual pigments we have? The lemurs are a key to this story. The first proto-primate ancestor probably was completely dichromatic. And the old world monkeys, those monkeys in Africa, developed trichromacy probably because of competition. The new world monkeys, however, do not have trichromacy, that is, three visual pigments, with the exception of the howler monkey. So the new world monkeys, except the howlers, have dichromacy and the howlers have three, trichromacy, meaning that we're watching evolution in the monkeys, the New World monkeys, the South American monkeys, now, as we speak. Of course, we're watching evolution as we speak among all animals, but this is color vision in process of evolving. And the real key to help understand this are the lemurs. The lemurs have the polymorphisms, the genetic equipment, to become trichromats, but they never have. There's even not even a hint in the females of becoming trichromatic, probably because the fruits are not so colorful. There's really no need for them. There's very little pressure, very little selection pressure to push them towards trichromacy. But the truth is we don't know why they haven't developed it. But like the old world monkeys, they could be developing it. They really still have only dichromacy. Well, what I've been telling you now is that basically these eyes evolved to niche. Whatever the animals needed to, whatever problem the animals need to solve, they do. Horizontal strips of focused or denser photoreceptors appeared. Swordfish, flamingos, even in lions with a savanna streak, so that concentrated areas of vision may be horizontal within certain eyes. Some insects, like the mantis shrimp, has those concentrated bands around the center of its eye so that they get more acute vision in that horizontal band. But other niche features appear. This is the largest eye ever known in Ophthalmosaurus related and related ichthyosaurs. This eye, animals now extinct,
This eye is about the size of a beach ball, and we know its radius of curvature because of these scleral ossicles, bony plates within the sclera. Enormous eye, this animal was the size of a double-decker bus and quite ferocious, and probably fed at 500 to 1,000 meters, hence trying to enlarge its eye to see even in those dim lit situations. Largest eye on Earth now is the giant squid, about the same size. Other eyes have evolved to niche that are good stories include the blue-striped marlin and the other billfish. This creature has extraocular muscles the size of a handful of sushi. What's it doing with these huge muscles? It doesn't have to move its eye very much, and the eye is the size of a tangerine. These muscles are not there solely for the purpose of movement. They are filled with mitochondria. They're filled with engines, and they're heaters. They heat the optics of the eye and the optics of the brain, or excuse me, heat the neurologic mechanisms of the brain. And the reason is that they like to lounge at about 50 meters, but they feed at 300 meters. So when they dive rapidly to feed, they may become aware of a school of herring, they'll dive rapidly. And what happens when you go from one thermal climate to another, from relatively warm water to cold water? Very much like drinking a Slurpee or an ice-filled drink, you get a what? A brain freeze headache. They can't afford a brain freeze headache. The eye's been proven to work better with this warmth as well. It has better mechanisms of what's called flicker fusion, putting together movement, as it were. So they've evolved to the niche that they want to fill. We say animals are as blind as a bat, or a friend is as blind as a bat. Bats aren't so blind, thank you. This is a fruit bat, the tube-nosed fruit bat, who likes to follow odor plumes in the forest with these odd nose probes. But he also happens to see very well at night. He sees about two or three times better than you do. And to discuss the retinal nutrition of this animal just slightly, I'll point out to you that he has a very unusual retinal vascular tree or retinal vascular supply. Instead of having retinal vessels in his retina, like we do and many other mammals do, he has essentially pegs that feed a vascular loop up into his retina, and it still works by diffusion, an odd little outlier of retinal nutrition. The pupils evolved. We have odd-shaped pupils, a W pupil. A horizontal pupil in a predator, unusual, and we don't know quite why. We have the tokay gecko with four pinholes, and we have Dr. Chris Murphy to thank us for understanding this. This is a Shiner's disc principle, meaning that it's essentially a rangefinder camera. It helps the animal understand distance with a uniocular vision with just one eye. Those pupils can constrict down to four single pinholes or can dilate to a complete circle, very much like your own eye. There are other odd pupils. This is a skate, again, with multiple pupils. And I think I want to thank Chris Murphy for that slide, although I'm not quite sure where this particular picture has come from. Well, I think I've told you then about a spectacular array of designs that have evolved, at least 10 different eyes. Pinholes, multi-element lenses, mirrors, aspheric lenses, multiple combinations, the neurologic machinery to match and accompany these unusual sensory mechanisms. I think I've shown you unusual pupils, unusual adaptations, unusual mechanisms to use their eye. And what I can say in conclusion is that the very basic eye proteins appeared very early. Certain of those proteins are highly conserved from the beginning to the present. Some of the proteins, though, like the lens proteins, are much younger. And an array of the designs have evolved and will continue to evolve, and probably because of predation. This is the arms race between the predators and prey. And vision has been a key driver of those arms races. It's a key distance sensory mechanism. So vision is an important driver of evolution. So before I answer any questions, I have a couple things I want to tell you. This is an interest of mine, and it is something I have been
allowed to accomplish because I have the cachet of extra training. So do you. You are receiving an education that allows you to do other things besides what you're trained to do. Don't restrict what you do. Don't use that as the box of your training. So to the students, I tell you, if you have something you like to do as your work, terrific. If you have something you like to do as your hobby, pursue it. Use the cachet of your education. You'll find it to be more valuable than just what you're particularly studying. You know how to find out about a topic. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll answer any questions. I have many of my 6 hours left, so I'll answer a question or two if there are any left. Okay, the fourth visual pigment is ultraviolet. The fifth visual pigment spreads more finely within the range that we see. It essentially enriches our level of perception. And some probably see a little further into the infrared, but the real infrared vision is with the snakes, and they do it entirely differently. The mantis shrimp has been spread all across the spectrum, yes.
It just comes.
If you want to talk about add in the rhodopsin, we have four.
Or melanopsin. And I'm curious if you know much about how that factors into the evolution thing. Some people presume that our melanopsin is most homologous actually to the rhodopsin that we see in other invertebrates and other, earlier species. And so how much does that change over time?
Here's the woman who reads. The melanopsin story is fascinating, and I didn't get into it because I can spend another hour on the cryptochromes, photolysis, melanopsin story. The melanopsin, and I may have hinted at this earlier, the melanopsin is in our ganglion cells, what she's alluding to, and those are photoreceptive, but not something you recognize. They are opsins that participate in the circadian rhythm, meaning that they help us understand day from night. They help us understand cycles, and probably responsible as to why I'm a little out of sorts with the two-hour jet lag. It probably plays some role there. The melanopsin story even gets more complicated. There are now known to be at least 1,000 opsins, and I didn't manage to read it in one of the journals this morning. It's probably 1,001. A man in San Diego, Bentner, is finding opsins that we don't know about every place he looks in the ocean. So there's probably a whole lot more of these photoreceptive compounds that I simply didn't get into it because of the time. But yes, we have melanopsin in our ganglion cells, at least a small subset. And the subset of cells doesn't go to the visual center. It goes elsewhere. It goes in the hypothalamus, I believe. The point is it's involved in circadian rhythm, not in vision per se. So she's quite right. And this is a vibrant area of research. Cryptochromes, melanopsin, photolysis, the photo repair mechanisms. This is love in the country. Yes?
When you lose or turn off a pigment receptor system, it seems like it'd be pretty tough to bring that back, depending on how badly the biology is degenerated over the years. So when primates bring them back, how close to the original form are they? The same receptor that was lost.
Sophisticated question, and quite right. For those of you who may not have heard it, said once you lose something evolutionarily, it's hard to bring it back. And that's right. This is all random. This isn't something that evolution plans out. Sometimes we speak of it as a conscious process. It isn't. It works by random error and great lengths of time. So the question is, if we lose two opsins from four and we come down to two opsins, what happens? How do we get that third back? Well, the one thing that evolution does do is it accepts errors, and those errors, it creates errors, and then accepts some of them. And probably what happened, gene duplication probably created a second pigment, really very close to, or a third pigment, very close to the second one. So we don't have, if you had a way of measuring the richness of vision in fish, we don't have that same richness because our visual pigments don't cover the same range quite as well. So really, we're just dichromats who've had a gene duplication that creates a visual pigment, an opsin, that is close to our second visual pigment. So you're right on target. The good news is that we tend, vertebrates tend to take a gene and work it to death. So essentially we've duplicated and set something aside. But you're right, it's hard to get back, and we don't have a fish out. Yes?
So you showed the pictures of bird vision of fish, and you draw the conclusion that stereo vision is involved. So can you see it again?
Sure.
What
evidence? I don't know if I can stop it, but the evidence is that they have a visual trident of a visual field. And the visual field is partly uniocular and partly uniocular on the other side, and then part of stereoscopic in front. Because they have two fovea, one position more laterally, the idea would be that once they are close enough to use both of those fovea together, they can put the image together. In other words, just like you have stereopsis, when you look at your thumb, and you're looking at your thumb with your fovea, beyond that, the chair behind it is in a different space in your visual cortex. You perceive that as three-dimensional. Same thing going on here, and this can be done by ray tracing, just by tracing where that image would fall on the second fovea. Is that clear? I'm making it muddier.
If a bird loses an eye, does it hurt its foot or bird action?
Yeah. Lots of humans are born with one eye, and they still function just fine. There are other clues for stereopsis. Does it hurt a bird to have only one eye in terms of stereopsis? The answer is, of course, yes. And they probably don't survive long. But could they still do a feat like that? Probably. But if the fish is aware of the animal coming and moves down substantially, it's just as if I were to patch one of your eyes and hand you a piece of paper. The first time I hand it to you, you're likely to grasp for it and miss it. The second time, though, you're going to be smarter and you're going to use other clues of what I'm doing. But likely is a bird would not survive losing one eye. The good eye, the second eye, will probably learn some ability to have at least some form of stereopsis, but not true stereopsis with just one eye. Still muddy or any clearer?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
When the brain evolved, did it do only the seeing part, or did it evolve to do all the other things?
When the what evolved?
The brain.
Brain.
So it started with getting the sunlight and processing it, whatever way it did. But the brain evolved later than the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Be careful that I'm the neurologist. When I sit around the neurologist, I get a raised eyebrow if I get an argument. But it's a fun argument.
Okay, so do we know that if the brain, the first brain that evolved, did only the seeing part or also did the other things?
Yeah, this all arose together. When I say that the brain is now pouching the eye, I mean it in a bit of a spoof. I mean it to stimulate the thought that it's really the sensory mechanisms that are pushing the development of the brain. And I'll give you the example that if you are hired for a job and you go into your office and you have nothing in your office, first thing you do is get a desk. You get some way to help you with the data you're going to have. People start giving you paper. You read and work with those papers. Pretty soon you get a stack of papers. Now you need some place to store those papers. Now you need a brain. So my analogy is that the simple sensory mechanisms probably don't require a brain. They probably work by reflex. So a lot of what I said depends on how you define an eye and how you define vision. Because vision isn't just the process of light coming into the eye, striking the retina. It's also a process in the brain, with the brain beginning to analyze color, analyze movement. So the brain is more than just the receptacle for what the eye is doing. But it is fun to bring up erythrogradiopsis to the neurologist and point out it has no semblance of a brain. Of course, their answer may be, well, it's the DNA. And regarding the scalps, I tell them the same thing about the scalps. But the scalps have a small nodes where there are concentrations of neuronal cells. Okay, so maybe those neuronal cells are the definition of brain. So it isn't that the eyes arose and then all of a sudden the brain arose. It all arose together. It evolved together, co-evolved, if you will. But don't take away that I seriously mean the whole eye evolved before the brain. It is a fun statement to wrestle with. Thank you very much for your attention.